This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today I have with me
Claire Randall,
Roger Clausen,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Roger, you were in at the beginning of the establishment of the hospice in Palmerston North.
Yeah, there'd been a real movement to establish a hospice in Palmerston North, and it was opened in 1991. And I knew that there was a hospice being planned, and then I was approached to see if I would join the board. And I think why they wanted me was I was a farmer, and they were talking about fundraising even at that early stage. So I was asked to join the hospice in 1993.
So the hospice itself got started then, or the organisation for the hospice?
Well, there was a movement in the mid-80s to establish a hospice, and that was led by the group of Christian churches, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it was the Christian Homes Trust of which Mary McKenna was involved, and she subsequently became a founding board member. And Garth Wallace must have been involved in that, and he was certainly involved in the Milton Rotary, so there's a lot of connections. So, as I understand it, Garth and Mary were really keen on establishing a hospice. I believe Te Amanga had probably been established in the sort of mid to late 80s, and so they did a bit of a
Te Amanga
hospice in Lower Hutt.
Yeah,
okay.
And so they did a bit of a road trip down there. Yeah. They had been involved, hadn't they, in building the Brightwater Villas.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think the story goes that they had $1,000 left from building those villas, and their constitution said that they should use that for something else for the community. Yeah. I can't remember the words exactly. And so the $1,000 kind of went into the pot for the establishment of the hospice. They had things like a telethon, you know, in those days
telethons. All the fundraising.
Remember those? Yeah. To fundraise.
The police were quite involved.
The police, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So was hospice a well-known concept at that stage?
No, I don't think it was. And in fact, when Mary and the others went down to Wellington to check it out, that was in the mid-80s, wasn't it?
Would have been, yeah.
And when they got, so it looked like something was going to happen, the Palmerston North Hospital Board at the time said, we don't need a hospice. And it kind of then become a bit of a battle, if you like, to get it going. But the people of Palmerston North wanted one, and that's what really drove them.
So what's the I suppose the selling point? What's the function of a hospice?
Well, it's about holistic care for people in their last months, weeks of life. I believe the hospital board's view was that they could do a good job in those days in the wards. But if we think about it, you know, when you're in your last days, weeks, months of life, you want to be surrounded by your family. If you need inpatient care, which is, you know, care in a ward situation or a specialist facility, which we still do here, and I'll probably talk a little bit later about how that has changed over time. It's much better for the patient and for the family to have that care in a place that solely looks after people in their last weeks, months.
I'd have to think on the same principle, wouldn't the maternity homes?
Similar principle. I mean, you know, we don't do four-bedded rooms, for example. Everybody has their own room with an ensuite. It's not just about medical care. It's about supporting the patient and the family in a sort of psychosocial way as well, spiritually. It's a very much a wraparound service. The hospital board, they were kind of the view they could do something over there, and it might be costly to do something else, I think.
Yeah, that's right, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was their sort of starting mantra, but then Garth and Mary obviously worked really hard to change their minds, which took a few years.
They got some allies like Phil Sunderland. He was a lawyer, and I think he had lost his wife or someone close, and he could see the need for a hospice.
Okay.
So he thought, well, better to try and change it by inside than from the outside.
Yeah.
So he stood for the Palmerston North Hospital Board and was elected.
Okay.
And I think he played quite a big part in getting them to come on board with the hospice.
Okay, so for getting started, there was a long political and fundraising.
And I think Dr. Poynter was probably, was he the big cheese at the hospital at that time? And he was probably brought in as a bit of an ally because the history of where hospice was going to be physically is that they bought, I believe, a villa in Albert Street.
Yeah.
Proposing to develop that. The villa, I think, is still there as you come out of the New World car park, sort of straight ahead of you on Albert Street. There's a villa.
They were ready to start renovations.
Yes, ready to start, And then the discussion with the hospital board must have progressed reasonably well, and the hospital board thought that the hospice should be within the hospital
the
grounds.
Yeah, the environment.
And at that time, this site at 1 Heratonga Street was Dr. Poynter's house as the medical superintendent
That's
of the hospital, wasn't it? And so they thought, oh, well, we will offer hospice this site, which was the medical superintendent's house. So they subsequently sold Albert Street and leased this block until they subsequently bought it. But I don't know if you noticed, Stuart, on your way through, the floor levels in here change. So you would have come down funny little ramps, and they make no sense. You know, that's because the medical superintendent's house is still in here, and it was built around. And so where we're sitting today was a family flat, was joined to the main building by an outside open pathway. And then there was There was like a conservatory and a lounge. Yeah. Totally different now. It's been developed over the years, but that's kind of the history. The medical superintendent's house is still in here.
In fact, when I was interviewed, I'm just trying to think who the chief executive was then. It would have
Gary
been,
Clee, Mervyn Monk.
Yeah, Mervyn Monk. He was ex trustee bank in Palmerston North, and he interviewed me, and I was sitting in a big lounge chair in the lounge, and it was just a house really, and really this whole complex has been added to, changed around to what we've got today.
Is there a lot of voluntary input into that for the construction or
Not so much for construction. I mean, we engaged it'll come to me in a minute,
the builders.
Chapel Architects.
Yeah, were,
David Chapel was really deeply involved in a lot of that work. I guess a lot of the changes have been around making sure that the building, if you like, keeps up with the way we deliver services and the way care has changed and services have changed over the years. So if we go back to when we opened in 1991, I think they opened with something like 8 beds.
Yeah.
There wasn't, aged care facilities weren't like they are today, so we didn't have options in terms of people. If people couldn't stay in their home, there wasn't really a good aged care option with palliative care support. So people came into the hospice, and it wasn't unusual to come in and be here for 6 weeks or so.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, Daphne Sowerby,
yeah.
Her husband was here for quite a long time. He was one of the first patients, and Daphne subsequently went on to be the most amazing volunteer and fundraiser for us, and raised over $100,000 just with craft things. And she kind of seeded the field in Friends of Hospice, and they're still going, an amazing group that donate $20,000 to us every single year through their fundraising. So yeah, the care now is moved more to community care. When we first started, we didn't have a community team, so we didn't have nurses out there visiting people all over the area, which we do now.
Okay, so now you started off with a small staff for in hospice care,
predominantly nursing. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Mainly nursing, and you're near the hospital, so doctors from the hospital.
In the early days, Alan Farnell was here as the he was the pain specialist over there, and then in the November after we opened, Simon Allen must have arrived.
Yes.
He was a medical oncologist from Scotland, and he was working across the way. And I think Alan said to him, "Oh, Simon, will you just do a little bit of, you know, just a little bit for us, or fill in for me?" Anyway, that turned into a career of over 30 years, and Simon has only recently retired as our medical director.
So what sort of staff do you have now? You got paid staff and then volunteers as well, don't
you? Well, yeah, paid staff. Most are part-time. There's not many of us that are full-time. And so there's over 120 staff. So it's a much bigger operation than it ever was 30-odd years ago. The biggest group will be nurses. We've got community nurses and nurses that work in the inpatient unit. We've got quite a big family support team, so that's social work, bereavement support, spiritual support, and we have an occupational therapist.
What's bereavement support?
So that's supporting families and patients before they die, because they will be feeling grief about departing, I guess. But it's about supporting the families after in their bereavement. So care doesn't stop when the patient dies. There's a big wraparound.
You know, say the person who was dying was the main income earner and handled the finances and those sort of things.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't always just then carry on rolling when that person passes, so there's support there for that.
Yeah, the family support team actually do quite a lot to help people set up their affairs. You know, we do a lot of enduring powers of attorney or encouraging people to do that. We don't physically do them, but, you know, that's really important.
I even help them to...
you know, making sure people have a will or some sort of... statement of their wishes.
Do you find many people have left it to that stage to formalise those sorts of things? Just the last few weeks?
Yeah, we certainly, you know, we certainly have patients where, and we have a really good deal going with one of the legal firms in town, that they will come and do a will for somebody, and it's sort of in those situations. So we would be doing wills, I don't know, probably do half a dozen a year, I suppose, help people to do that.
But it's also supporting the living partner, you know, who might be faced with things to do that they haven't been. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So how long? I'm aware of that. Like, as you said, if one partner handled all the finances, then suddenly the other one's having to do it.
Yeah, and there's also the family support team do quite a bit around what we call carer support.
Yeah.
So most people stay at home. So there's only about 27% of people who actually come in for an inpatient stay.
So
most
of
the care happens at home. So we support the carers, and we do like a carer support three sessions where we just talk them through patient care, you know, the fact that people...
nursing skills and stuff?
A little bit of that. But practical things like... you know, don't get too caught up on, you know, if your family member doesn't want to eat a full meal. Little and often, and just eat whatever they want to eat, that sort of thing. We'll give them some guidance on medications, because often that's really daunting for patients and families. All of a sudden they've got all these medications to manage, that sort of thing, and preparing people for, you know, as I say, get your well done, get things sorted, and just help people through that.
And you were saying support after the death, but how long would that, I suppose, some
would vary,
just very quickly.
Partners who remain would probably handle everything, but I don't know too much about how long it goes for.
There is a bit of a process in that there will contact will be made at certain time points over the next year. And the family support team are very aware of those people that need extra support, and so can support them in the way they need to be. We often have a what we call a bereavement morning tea. That's so we bring people in who are recently bereaved, and you know, they get to meet other people in similar circumstances and just get that support. We've had, you know, memorial services where there might be 100 people come with, you know, families of people who have died, and they do a candle lighting.
So the hospice does
ceremony.
That.
Yep,
we've got a chaplain, haven't we?
Yes. So George is now sort of in charge of that bereavement support. So that's all the stuff that he does, and that provides really good support and closure to people. So these are all the hidden things.
Yeah, that's what I mean. All the things that you don't know.
But it's total support, really.
Okay. And you've got a lot of... First of all, is it sort of a profession? Is there training for this?
Or absolutely. It's a specialty, okay? Yeah. So, and it's quite a new specialty. So when Simon arrived as the medical oncologist who was providing the medical support here, he then went on and did his specialty in palliative care. Mm-hmm. And it is a... it is a full-blown specialty. The medications we use and the way we use medications have changed. In 30 years, I can remember someone in Foxton who was 30 years ago was on really, really high doses of medicine for her pain. Now we don't use doses anything like that, but we use what we call adjuvant medications, so other medications that work with the pain relief, and so you don't need to use as much pain relief. So there's a whole movement that's kind of changed the way we use medicines. But getting back to the specialty, we also train, we do training for registrars, so get them up to medical specialist status. We've got nurse practitioners who their scope is in palliative care. And I'm a pharmacist by trade. I've done my pharmacist prescribing, and my scope is in palliative care. So it's definitely a specialty. We share that knowledge and education with all of the general practitioners in town, with a palliative care partnership education program for the GP and their practice nurse, so that they have a level of knowledge to be able to look after their patients that, you know, they've probably had for 30 or 40 years. And then we provide the specialist support on top.
So how far is this specific to Palmerston North then? So you're saying all the training and the links, is it unique to Palmerston North, or this is national?
The palliative care partnership part is fairly unique to Palmerston North. It was developed here. It has, you know, been taken up by other areas, but the palliative medicine training is national. It's a little patchy. We don't always get as much funding here as we would like, and yet somewhere like the Waikato seems to be quite a bit luckier with the funding. But it is a nationwide.
When we did one major extension, we were going to build 10 rooms, and then we thought, well, we might not need them. The access is still there to, if we wanted to, because more and more people were staying at home, weren't they?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Was that their choice, or just you're able to support them better at home now?
Well, back in, the early 2000s, we realised with the patient numbers that we couldn't do everything with an inpatient unit. We also couldn't do everything ourselves. So that was kind of the birth of the palliative care partnership. It was also the time when we employed community nurses. So when we opened, no community nurses. We've now got 12 FTE, so 12 full-time slots. We care for people in their homes because that's where people want to be. You know, the myth that RNO hospice, I talk to so many people and they say, oh gosh, you must be busy, how many beds have you got? And they think we've got 200 beds here. We've got 230 people on the books, but we probably have four in the inpatient unit today because everyone else is looked after in their home. So the big area that we provide care for is that there's over 200,000 people in the area. Okay, so that's Peka Peka Road in the south, right up to beyond Waiuru. And then we do the Tararua, Norswood to Ikerahuna. And then we have a contract for part of the Whanganui district, which is the Rangitiki. So that's sort of the Hunterville, Martin, out to Turakina Beach. So huge area. So what we do is we divide that into three bits. And we have a team of three in each bit. Three community nurses plus a social worker now in those teams. And so they're out there every day, Monday to Friday, and then at the weekend there's a couple of people on. So there's always support for people in the home. We also have a team that go into aged care. So that's the rest of the 12. So and as I said, there's only 27% of people that ever have an inpatient stay, usually to fix their symptoms, sort things out for them, and then they go home again. The myth that there's one way in and one way out is a myth. Some people do come into hospice to die, but more than half, absolutely more than half, go home.
But there's a lot more now in the way of, say, equipment and support and things to make the homes more suitable for
Oh, there is. There needs to be more, I have to say. Just the other day, I saw the nurses going out with what looked like they looked like they were going away for months. They had a lot of equipment and stuff. Incontinence products and things that we don't have a contract to supply. But this person that needed them, there was no. They were at home. There was nothing in place that the Te Whatu Ora had put in place for them to comfortably be at home, so we kind of filled the gap until they can get an assessment done for that stuff. So there is support, but there can always be more.
So if you're in here or in your own home, care and advice is available 24 hours
24/7. So how we manage that is that the nurses in the inpatient unit take all the calls 24/7. If somebody needs some help in terms of medical advice or help, we have a doctor on call 24/7. So we have a charting system that's online so that the doctor can chart new medicines if they're required. Between myself and the other pharmacist, we also take turns at being on call. So if somebody needs a new medicine at 2 o'clock in the morning, we will come and dispense that new medicine from here. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the ambulance service help us out with going out to patients. Before 10 o'clock, the district nurses help us out with going out to patients if they need help in the home. And we also have one of our senior nurses on call every day of the week as well. So there's lots of support out there, and we can mobilise people if they need help at home.
Right. And the reception from people, obviously, they're very grateful, I take it.
They are very grateful, and well, I'm not sure if I should say this, but given that there's many holes in the rest of the health system, when they come here, you know, nobody ever wants to be referred to hospice, but when they come here, you can often just see the load just kind of lightens, yeah. And they're like, so many times they say, oh, wow, if I'd known it was like this, I would have come weeks ago.
They can just sort of self-refer? Or
They can self-refer into the service. If that happens, and it does happen, we would then go back through the GP or to get the medical information,
right. Yeah.
Because there are criteria. Most of our referrals come from general practice or from the doctors in the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can just, sorry,
okay.
It might be going back, but if I can give an example of what hospice care means to people is my mother, she was in the hospital, she had bad heart, and she was 89 and her organs were failing, and we went up there and she was almost crying in pain, and we had to go and, you know, they were all working flat out and probably trying to do more than they could. We got somebody and he came and had a look, and then he went away and come back and he said, your mother's not going to get better, so all we can do is give more morphine. And I thought when the hospice started, just how that would have been appropriate.
Yeah, because I guess that's a really good point, Roger, just to follow up on that. When hospice started, it was pretty much all about cancer. Now 30% of our patients have a different sort of life-limiting illness. They might have a bad heart, they might have kidneys, kidney failure, respiratory, COPD, emphysema, that sort of thing, motor neurone disease. There's a number of different diseases, and so our sort of scope of practice is quite broad now. All of those diseases, all of the age ranges, really, predominantly sort of 65 and over, I suppose. That's the majority of people, but it's not uncommon, unfortunately, to be caring for younger people.
And to us, it was a horrible death, you know, the pain and suffering.
Yeah, when I think about now the tools we've got in the toolbox to help people like Roger's mum, you know, the medications that we've got, and we wouldn't just keep upping the morphine. We wouldn't. Because there's other things that you can do to... that aren't going to cause other problems.
Dr. John
Crowley.
Yeah, Crowley, he was on the board, and he said to me one night after a board meeting, it's a real privilege to be giving direction to the people who are standing at the bedside at 2 a.m. in the morning dealing with that patient, you know. It's always there.
This is part one of two. Listen next week for part two. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.